This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here's another trial that we've been waiting roughly 30 years for. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is going to trial in Las Vegas for the 1996, 30 years ago, murder of Tupac Shakur, nearly 30 years after the shooting. He wasn't caught by forensics or witnesses who flipped. He was caught, prosecutors allege, because he couldn't stop talking about it. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help break down what to expect as the trial for the murder of Tupac actually begins. Keefe D, he wasn't caught by DNA. He wasn't caught by detective work. He allegedly got himself arrested by writing a book. His 2019 memoir, Compton Street Legend, describes being in the white Cadillac, providing the gun and ordering the retaliation hit on Tupac after Tupac's crew beat Davis's nephew at the MGM Grand. He said the same things in a BET documentary. He said the same things in police interviews. Las Vegas Homicide says those public statements were what brought the investigation back to life after sitting cold for decades. Did this man talk himself into the murder charge, Eric?
Yeah, I think absolutely. He's been popping off for years and years and bragging about, oh, being involved in killing the, you know, a beloved artist in so many people's hearts. And so, yeah, that is, he has himself to blame. If he's sitting in that jail cell and wondering, why am I here? It is because he could not keep his mouth shut.
The reason Keefe D. Davis says that he talked, the only reason he told police anything was because he was promised immunity in 2008. It's called a proffer agreement. And remember that term. A proffer deal is where he cooperated with the LAPD on the Biggie Smalls investigation and gave up what he allegedly knew about Tupac's murder in exchange for protection from prosecution. So they were looking for information in the Biggie case. And he said, I can tell you things, but I don't want to be prosecuted for anything I'm about to tell you, but it could help you. He alleges they had that sort of proffer agreement there that said, okay, you're immune from anything that you tell us. Okay, so he talks. His attorneys fought to suppress those statements. The judge let them in. Let's talk about what that first means, Eric, a proffer agreement. Is it a black and white sign here? You're never going to be prosecuted. Is it a gentleman's agreement? What exactly is he talking about?
The term gentleman might be a little generous in some of the scenarios I've been in, but you know, it can often be very informal. It's kind of like, the law enforcement's like, hey, dude, you're screwed on this and we're going to make it really bad for you. But if you tell us some good stuff that we can use, we'll make it less bad for you. And the person's like, less bad? What does that mean? Like, what are the parameters of this? And so sometimes if I ever have a client do this, I have at least some pillars of the agreement in writing agreed to by both sides, because this is the problem that arises is later on, KPD's like, I thought you said I wouldn't get in trouble for saying this stuff. And then they're like, well, we didn't talk about you saying this stuff outside of this context. And it's all a big confusing mess. And so sometimes it's unclear.
Is it almost, I mean, is it relied on sometimes by law enforcement to essentially set someone up and get them to speak more readily by omission of not informing them that, okay, within the context of this conversation, we can't go after you. But if you go on camera, if you go on BET, if you go on Vlad's podcast, if you go on whatever and talk about all of this shit, if you write a book about it, that we can go after you for, even if it's the exact same things you've told us, simply by omitting the fact that you can't go out there and talk about that, we're going to get you for it. But is that even the agreement with every proffer agreement? It seems like a very gray area agreement that sometimes criminals put a little bit too much faith in of what they can talk about and what they can't talk about, and they don't really seem to understand that there's not really anything set in stone here to begin with.
I am so reluctant every time that this possibility comes up to advise a client to do a proffer for these very reasons that we're talking about, because you just don't know you can't foresee all of the possible contingencies down the road that could come up. And certainly the prosecution has no incentive to say, hey, but we won't prosecute you for X, but if you do Y or Z or A, B, C, D, E, F, then yeah, we will. They're not going to lay all that out. It's not in their interest to do that. And so, yeah, it just becomes very messy. And I think people should be very reluctant about doing it and about the information that comes from it at times.
The prosecution, they're not arguing that Keefe D pulled the trigger on this 30-year crime now. They say his nephew, Orlando Anderson, is the one who did it, fired the shots from the backseat of that white Cadillac, retaliation for the casino beatdown hours earlier that we all probably have seen the video clip of around the fountain. Anderson denied involvement before he died. He was killed in an unrelated Compton shooting in 1998, so 28 years ago he's been gone. So he can't testify. He can't be cross-examined. The gun has never been recovered. The prosecution's entire theory is that Davis was the shot caller, baller, 20-inch blaze, Zona Impala. The one who gave the order and supplied the weapon, basically. The alleged shooter dead. So how do you prove the order? And how do you prove he made the order when most of the witnesses are dead and this was 30 years ago? There's no digital trail, just the gangsta brags of Keefe D out there in social media and wherever he decided to talk.
As a general rule, if you're going to, as the prosecutor, have statements against a defendant, like he was the orchestrator and he did this and he did that, you've got to have the declarants of those statements come into court and say it. And if they are 6 feet underground, that's not happening. So you don't have that evidence, but most likely. And so you've got to have this gamed out in terms of how you're going to get from A to B to C and bring this jury along to have them reach that ultimate conclusion. And if you just have some guy who likes popping off to BET, that might not be enough.
Is it enough, though? I mean, at the end of the day, you go to a jury, you present all this stuff, and I know he's going to try and argue it and fight it, but you got that interview, this interview, that other interview, the book, him constantly saying and bragging about doing this. Why should a jury, for any reason? I mean, this seems like it could be somewhat of a slam dunk because you actually have the defendant saying he did it over and over and over and over. And now suddenly, oops, nope, I thought I was only talking like this for this reason. And now it's not. I mean, how do you think a jury's going to react to that?
I think alleged confessions are some of the most compelling evidence of guilt that we have in a trial. You got to start with that premise that this is going to move a jury. They're going to say, hey, he admitted to this, and not once, not twice, but a bunch of times. And so in jury selection, from the defense perspective, you have to kind of prime this jury to say, hey, I know we all think that, like, when a person, we hear that a person may have confessed to something, that must be it, right? Well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about false confessions? Have you thought about ulterior motives? Have you thought about why a person might say they did something that they didn't do, and hope you get a jury receptive to that if you're on the defense side?
Just basically, yes, he said it, but he said it for profit. He did it to self-enrich himself, and you can say he's a shitty person for making up stories that weren't his to make money off of, but at the end of the day, he's not a killer, even though, and you don't have, and their backup to that is a lot of people who could place him where he claims he was are dead. So, yeah, there's a lot of question there. Keefe D placed himself in the Cadillac in his 2008 police proffer. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his BET documentary. He placed himself in the Cadillac in his own memoir and described providing the gun and ordering the hit. Then after his arrest in 2023, he told ABC News he's innocent. I ain't killed nobody, he said. He said he only talked about the murder to make money. He even claimed at one point he wasn't even in Vegas when the shooting happened, contradicting his own book, his own documentary, and his own statements to police. I made it all up for money. Does that work as a defense, or didn't, or he didn't make a dime off the proffer, or did he think that the proffer was the ticket to money because of that? He could then talk after all of this went down.
You know, but put a different way, is there reasonable doubt as to the reliability of his confessions? Is there an alternative plausible explanation as to why he would do this, that he wanted money, wanted notoriety, that kind of thing? Maybe. And then, you know, one thing you look at, too, is whether his confessions can be objectively corroborated or refuted by other evidence. You know, is there photographic evidence, video evidence, travel plans, receipts, bank statements, things like that, that could place him in certain places or not? And if we're talking about something that happened 30 years ago, there might not be a ton of corroboration. And so how reliable is that confession?
At the end of the day on this one, I mean, he started talking in 2008 in that proffer agreement, and then he started talking after that in all the places we just talked about. Why did it take all of these years to make an arrest? What's your thought process there? Why now? Why wait all this time to finally go after Keefe D? I mean, why? Oh, well, you finally, the BET documentary, that wasn't enough. The interview over here, that wasn't enough. The book, that wasn't enough. I mean, like, what made the DA finally go, you know what, maybe we should go after this guy because he keeps talking about this?
It's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer. Why now? Why?
Yeah.
Why under these circumstances? And I think those are questions the defense needs to ask the jury rhetorically in closing argument. That, you know, if they really had the goods, you know, things haven't changed significantly in the past 5 years. They could have brought this 5 years ago or longer than that ago. They didn't. They're doing it now for some other reason. And if defense can give a compelling alternative reason why the prosecution might do that, that just further contributes to reasonable doubt possibly.
I don't know the answer to that question either. I do wonder, and I don't know what the situation is. I haven't dug into this, but obviously we do see a lot of situations where we go, why are they prosecuting this right now? And you go, oh, someone's up for election and they want to have that in their little commercial. Like, I'm the one who put so-and-so away for the murder of so-and-so. I can't say that's what's going on, but we do see it quite a bit. I just don't know the answer to that question. Anyway, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will follow this trial as it gets underway 30 years late. All right. Until next time. For Eric, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too. Because where you get your information matters.